You're listening to the Script Lab podcast. I'm Shani Edwards.
I'm excited to share my interview with director Alfonso Gomez Rejon about his stunning new film, The Current War Director's Cut. It's the surprising story about Edison, Westinghouse, and Tesla, the men responsible for bringing electricity to the American marketplace in the late 1800s. The screenplay is by Michael Mitnick. Alfonso was nominated for 2 Emmys for directing and producing American Horror Story, 2014, and you might remember his heartfelt indie film Me and Earl and the Dying Girl from 2015. The Current War is in theaters now. Let's hear a clip. This is Thomas Edison, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, addressing the press.
Oh, you got vultures in every venture, but you just got to keep them away.
So this is just how it works.
Map makers include mistakes in their work to see if anyone else is copying them. Well, I don't have that luxury. I can't invent streets to lead the world down. Otherwise, we all end up in the dark. Good. Remember, as much as you can about how he's infringing.
Thank you, Mr. Edison. And thanks for this.
Did I mention that his system's lethal? You reach out and touch a doorknob or a rail and, well, you become the circuit.
Just to be clear on that point.
Will you die?
All right. Hi, Alfonso.
Hi.
So great to talk to you. Your movie, The Current War, The Director's Cut, is an absolutely beautiful film. It's thrilling. It's exciting. It's such an important story. I think that this story affects our lives every day, and most people don't know the story of Westinghouse and Edison and Tesla.
Yeah, it was. I didn't know enough about it myself when I read Michael Mitnick's screenplay. I knew a little bit about the war. The Currents knew very little about Westinghouse. Had an interest in Tesla that was actually fairly recent, you know. But I was attracted to some of the themes in the story, and which is what drove me to make it. And the deeper and deeper I got into the research, the more exciting it became.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of this, making this film, because you had an interesting journey, right? Originally, the Weinstein Company was supposed to release it.
Yes.
And through a series of events, that didn't work out for you.
Right.
So tell me what happened, because I have a feeling there might have been a time when you thought, uh-oh, this might not get released at all.
The worse than that, it's the wrong version of the movie being released and that being out forever. That's worse. It was not unusual for some filmmakers within that studio to have it to face these kinds of hurdles to get your vision out into the world. I mean, that happens in a lot of studios, but this one's famous for it. But I walked in there with my eyes open, feeling that I had enough language in, let's say, my contract protecting my vision and my final cutting rights, and I really needed to make this movie. And then, leading up to TIFF, was there was a lot of intervention, a lot of notes, at some point you have a choice to walk away or keep fighting. To win more of the battles and get a film that's closer to your vision out into the world. And there was still time. TIFF was, I think, early September, and the film, I think, was going to be out Thanksgiving or Christmas, so there was still time to fight. And what happened was that TIFF, it became the defining moment of the film. It was judged as the final product, like a final cut, as opposed to a work in progress. And after that, you lose some leverage as a filmmaker. It went through, the studio did their cuts, and there were more back and forth. And just when you're at your lowest at times, or sometimes have an idea that it might actually unlock the film, the New York Times story broke, the New Yorker story broke, and then we were on hold indefinitely. And that year of silence was so incredibly hard, a year and a half, not knowing, again, like you said, will the film ever be seen? And two, which version of the film will I ever get a chance to actually recut the film and make it to the one I wanted to make? And then a year and a half or so later, I've lost count. But I found myself in the cutting room looking at my footage again.
And at some point, you, a acquired some help from Martin Scorsese. Is that true?
That when I mentioned earlier that I had a clause in my contract that said if Harvey and I were battling and could have come to an agreement on what was the final cut of the film, that Scorsese would have the final say of what the best version of the film was, which is a place I never wanted to go. It was just like you had some kind of safety net, but you never wanted to call in that favor. And eventually we all woke up to a story in the trades that my film was going to get an international release, and no one knew what version of the film and who had given them the rights to the film, because the film wasn't officially legally final because this clause had never been enacted. And then as soon as Scorsese got the call that he now had final cut, he just handed it to me, and that was that.
And how did you develop a relationship with Martin Scorsese?
I'd always been, I guess, an artist, and I was a fan of the filmmaking and the craft, or whatever the little I knew from, the border in the 80s. And it was a VHS revolution, so I just started going to the video store and just watching films. And when I saw Mean Streets, that really did something to me because it was incredibly personal to me. It was a lot of what I was living through, even though I'm not Italian-American and it's not 1970s Little Italy. But it just spoke to me directly. And then I started to follow his path and went to NYU because he went there. And the second I landed in New York, I wanted to work for him, and everyone thought I was nuts. But in about 3 years, I started working at his office as an intern. Then I went out to Vegas with him as his assistant on set. And it just became, it's been 20-something years now. And it's just, I idolize him. He's a hero of mine. And the fact that he was willing to help me out with this, it wasn't a favor I wanted to ask. I mean, it was just something my agent said, just to have it in there just in case the things tend to go bad at that studio. So before you go in there, just have this just in case. And then things went to bad to worse to surreal, because it was a collapse of a studio and the downfall of someone you never thought would ever evaporate the way it happened seemingly overnight and when you're in the thick of it. So it was that little clause, I'm here because of it. I'm like still standing because of it.
Is there anything specific you can point to that you learned as a result of working with Scorsese?
Throughout the years?
Throughout the years, yeah. Or Marty, I guess they call him.
Well, I think appreciation of film history and that the humility that comes with how little one knows and whose shoulders you're standing on, right? And I think the why making of the why you want to make a certain movie. It's not just a gig. It's not just a job. I mean, there has to be something personally you latch on to and do some kind of self-examination and exploration while you're making a movie, and then maybe you leave something behind that documents who you were at the time. And because I wanted to make this one, and it was so clear why, is why I'm still here talking about it, because if that wasn't so clear, I would have walked away a long time ago, because the pain was too intense and the mind games and all that kind of stuff they go along with that. That post process was insane, but you had to keep fighting because there was a better version of the movie. And then when I had this opportunity, the movie hadn't been released yet, so you have this. You still have this hope. I mean, once it's out, there's very little you can do. You just know you gave your best and under those conditions, and that's that. But because it wasn't out, I was still reworking it in my head, hoping that I'd have a chance to get back into the cutting room.
So this movie tells the story of bringing electricity to the American public. And there are three central characters that are real people: Thomas Edison, Nikola Tesla, and Westinghouse. And they each had different ideas about how electricity should work and how it should be distributed. One thing that was interesting to me is that Edison was really stuck on direct current, correct? And my understanding of direct current, and you can correct me, is that it's sort of like a string of Christmas lights, and if one light goes out, then they all go out.
Right.
Whereas Westinghouse and Tesla were both advocates of alternating current, right, which is much more successful, mm-hmm. correct? So why was Edison so stuck on direct current?
I've asked this question before, and the best answer I got back was because it was his idea. And acknowledging that he was wrong and someone else had a better idea was something he was incapable of doing. That's the best answer I got. See, I've asked the same one.
Okay. Very good. My listeners are probably going to kill me because I'm going to talk about Prometheus again. I just saw the film The Lighthouse.
I can't wait to see it.
It's so good.
I can't wait.
And in many ways, it's a Promethean story. But this film is literally a Promethean story about bringing light. Is that one of the themes that you played with? Or maybe you can share like the themes you came to in the movie.
Yeah. It was a combination of a few things. It's a few different ideas. Originally, the entire story is that I was going to make another movie after Me and Earl and Dying Girl, and I dropped out of that, and it was a chance. It was a big kind of Hollywood thing, and I got incredibly depressed after that, and I wasn't sure why this was happening to me. Like this was obviously the right thing to do is pull out, and your body was telling you this is, and right, you have an idea of what this is. You're being pulled in a different direction, and then you're not made for it. And then I just started, I picked up the script again, and these themes of ego and humility, there was an imbalance there, and like, why exactly was I going through this pain? It didn't make any much sense, you know, because I know the kind of filmmaker and the kind of films I want to make and why. And so I started seeing the film more about this, about ambition and the tension between that and humility. Because as an artist or as a filmmaker, you want to make films that last the test of time, I guess. And maybe there's a connection to invention as well. These are solutions that last, you know. But there was that imbalance that I think was interesting for me to kind of start doing a self-exploration. And then there were themes. You see, I've had time with the film now because usually the film is... We were supposed to shoot and release within the same year, which is really hard for a movie of this size. And then you add a festival and you already cut your post schedule by a few months, you know. So this needed some time. And because I had that one time, that one year of just like silence and reworking it and looking back at it, I can see that I was also... And someone else pointed out to me too. Sometimes you need someone else to point it out to you. But there are certain themes of mortality and legacy that I was playing around with still with Me and Earl. That was an answer to my dad's death and not understanding how to grieve. And I can see how this could be. I was, and the more, especially towards the last few months of post on this final version of the film, I can see so much of the grieving that Edison was doing and his trying to defy nature and losing over and over again, but still looking ahead and never being still enough to realize it of his own failures. So he's looking into the future and constantly coming up with the next idea. But there's a lot of giving death a shape and taming the elusive, like Sound in a Box or motion pictures or memories in motion pictures or in Light in a Jar, whatever that those kind of abstractions are, he was able to tame them and trap them. And that, I think, I started to see a lot more of myself in that. And other things that are more intellectual, that are the left side of the brain that kind of are always there, but like unintended consequences of technology and all that, of the double-edged sword of the light bulb that leads to the electric chair or social media that leads to loneliness, even though it's meant to connect us. And all those ideas were also always there. This social network, 1893, were always a part of the story. But I think what drove me to make it was with this the feud between ego and humility within myself, I think.
It's such a great story. And again, it's a story that most people don't know. You refer to the characters, or at least one character, as a futurist. Do you consider yourself a futurist?
No, God, no. No, I mean, it was a fun idea. It was actually something we played around with in the very first cut of the film, the director's cut of the original director's cut of the film. To have just enough exposition in these titles so people aren't stopping and talking in exposition. You just kind of, and you can't call them all inventors, you know, it's not that interesting. So inventor and then industrialist and futurist, but we really was. I mean, he was looking 100 years into the future. I would never begin to compare myself to any of them.
You mentioned going from a light bulb to an electric chair. So in the beginning of the film, Edison is very clear that he doesn't want to make weapons. I'm curious, what kind of weapons do you think they would have made if he said, sure, let's get on board?
They were talking about firearms and, you know, all these kinds of, and I think there's a whole scene that we had a little more of that scene of J.P. Morgan wanted him to build for General Sherman. But I don't think munitions mainly, but I don't think I don't think Edison ever went into this thinking of creating some kind of dark dystopia. But that's what happens sometimes with new technology. If it gets in the wrong hands, you have no idea where it might lead.
Right, and then the debacle of the electric chair doesn't go so well.
Right.
Which he does only to smear Westinghouse, right?
Right.
He has no personal interest in it.
No personal interest at all, and it's important to know that his wife is gone by then, and he loses that person in his life that was able to kind of bring him back to center.
Now let's talk a little bit about Tesla. I've done a little research on him, and he seemed like a brilliant guy, but very eccentric. Mm-hmm. Did you think about bringing more of his eccentricities into the screenplay or to the movie, or he just was sort of a minor figure to you?
Never a minor figure. It was always going to be a secondary role. I mean, we always knew that, and we always knew that going into it that everybody would want more Tesla, but there's only one shape of the film, and it was always going to be both of them, with him being like the motor between them, literally, and the link to the future. But we did have a few more scenes of Tesla. We had an entire opening. Michael Mitnick and I, when we were working in pre-production, as an exercise almost of, okay, let's put more of the true events in the film. And we ended up with a movie that was unmakeable. It was too long, but it was actually exciting to see how we started to combine characters and add more details into the story. And I remember the Tesla's original introduction was in Paris, and he was swimming laps and counting laps, which I still remember those sketches of what it was going to look like. And it was just a kind of a really wonderful introduction to him. And I think we had a scene. Pears, right? Peaches, I think he couldn't stand the look of them and the texture. We had a little more details about his eccentricities, but it became a different movie, and it became too big that we couldn't manage it just to shoot it. Just we had the resources to shoot it. So they're there a little bit. I mean, he's in Serbia and he's counting his steps as he walks up to Edison's lab. He opens the door not with his hand, but with his foot. He doesn't want to shake Edison's hand, but he does reluctantly. There are a few things like that, and maybe one little scene that was cut later. I know that was cut where someone tries to give him a handshake and he refuses. But I think this is as much of that. Otherwise, you know, you do a little too much and it becomes comedic.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say he had obsessive compulsive disorder.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he counted everything in threes and would only stay in hotel rooms that ended in a three.
In the hotel room scenes, he has a three canes, a three shoes, and is slanted. He thinks this room is slanted by a couple of degrees. So, but anything more than that, and you wouldn't respect him as much. So I don't know. It was too comedic.
Yeah.
And just in Nick Holt, just a really beautiful job is just enough.
He was great. I think
He's
one of
so
my
great.
Favorite performances of his. He really went for it. You mentioned to me a little bit about your personal history of growing up on the border.
Yes.
Which is very different than the rest of Texas. How is this movie about electricity personal to you?
Other than the universal themes of mortality, legacy, ambition, and all that I think we all have a bit of them in us, you know? There was a certain something that Michael and I worked on about the fence metaphor that is more of a literal reference to the fences are on my border that are on my mind constantly, that the divide more than unite, and also this kind of this disinformation of Edison's that he uses in the media until it becomes gospel is something that's pretty relevant to me today. Literally there's a whole metaphor of a fence that's a literal one that's Mary Edison's that she wants him to build, and the virtual one that Westinghouse calls him on at the end, and how much better we'd be without it. In that respect, there's a little secret agenda maybe I was putting out there that I thought was important to me, that I've seen it play on the border, and you hear some people get it in ways that it does that other audiences don't, but that's okay. But other than that, it was more about the universal themes, really not specific to the border, really.
Let's talk about the female characters.
Yes.
The wives. We lose one to congestion of the brain.
Yes.
Is that like a brain tumor?
Yeah, you know, when Mary Edison died, it's unclear exactly if it was a brain tumor or a overdose of morphine.
Right, because the doctor leaves her the laudanum.
Yeah, and it's unclear exactly how she died. She was sickly. She was always home. And then his second wife, Mina Stillwell, I believe her last name is. I may have the last names wrong, sorry. Was much more active than in his life. So we combined the attributes of both of them and made it into, I think, a beautiful role that Tuppence Middleton place, and it's so nuanced, and she's there for a little bit, but then she's there in so many other ways until the very end, in little messages that she left behind, and in motion pictures, and in a memory of Niagara Falls. So she's always around, and you can see, and you can tell that she's kind of haunting him in a weird way as maybe a failed invention of some sort. And she's incredibly, she just does a beautiful job, because you see her kind of see how what a crucial role she played in his life, and then Catherine Waterston was always treated as an equal by Marguerite Westinghouse, and it was always treated as an equal by George, which is why her title is wife and partner, because she was an equal of his.
Yeah, that's great. I loved seeing both of those men's relationships with their wives and how the support was there and the respect was there.
Yeah.
And obviously the loss when Edison's wife, Mary,
yes,
when she dies. Yeah. It was very a very emotional part of the film. One thing that I'm, as a writer, I'm attracted to is sort of this industrial revolution and this time in the world when technology was completely changing. It was going to change every aspect of our lives. We're sort of there now again. AI is happening. We have Elon Musk, who's like him or not, I don't know. He's made these Tesla cars, and he's got big dreams. How do you see the time of the film relating to the time now where we're at with technology?
I think 15 years ago, Facebook didn't exist, and now it's Sweden election. I think we tend to, technology and culture go hand in hand, and we tend to adapt to, whether it's a light bulb or the flushing toilet or whatever it is, we tend to adapt. But usually I think we need a certain amount of psychological flexibility, I think, to adapt now, because things seem to be moving so fast. I mean, I was reading about consciousness being uploaded to the cloud at some point. I mean, everything is possible, and how do we adapt to something like that? So if 15 years ago there was no Facebook, like, what's going to happen in 2 years and 5 years? So it only puts more, it's the human side of technology and whoever's behind these inventions and these new ideas to think about unintended consequences. What if it's in the wrong hand, or if the wrong people control it? What can it lead to? So that's the Westinghouse, like, ethical approach to all those decisions, and how could it be the best thing? How could you leave the world a better place through it, not just create a demand for something? And I think Edison created things from scratch, and then the demand followed. And I think there's a genius in Westinghouse's the contextualization of the new ideas. And I think that's where we should be, what, you know, what we should be thinking of.
So if you could have dinner with Westinghouse, Edison, or Tesla, who would you choose and why?
I probably want to have dinner with Tesla and hear him out. I mean, I think he saw things so far into the future that there's so much a theme of communication in the film, just in how love is expressed, either through Morse code in Edison's world or through a direct kind of flow expressive kind of love and through contact with the Westinghouses and Tesla, who's kind of isolated because he's just living in an alternate reality that is very real in his head. And I just want to have him feel like he's being heard. I don't know. And where he gets his fine clothes.
That's great. Again, this movie is just, it's so good. It's beautiful. It's a masterpiece in so many ways. What are you working on next?
I'm not sure. It's interesting. They're not pilots anymore, I guess. They're called first episodes of series. But I wasn't able to really let go and make another film until this one was out in the world, because that would have meant that this one was over and it wasn't ready. I wasn't ready to give up yet. But now that it's out, I'm open, and I think there's a couple of things that are coming together, but I'm a little superstitious until that I'm actually finally shooting. But hopefully they're personal in some way, and hopefully I'm growing as a filmmaker with each one of them, I hope.
My listeners are mostly screenwriters who are trying to get their films made. Do you have any writing advice for someone who's up and coming? How should they try and get the attention of studios and directors?
I think it's always, I used to write a lot more than I do now. I'm starting to write again. And I'm reading a lot and working with a lot of writers. It's just a personal, not writing for what you think is commercial or what you think is might be, because it might be just be a passing fad. It's just personal stories. I mean, how to kind of put yourself or maybe hide yourself in the work. And there's a part of you in there, because that's what I think I connect to. Is just a personal, an original voice, as opposed to something that is the kind of perfectly, kind of the craft of it is perfect, but there has to be some soul there, and it only comes from putting yourself out there.
Well, I hope everybody goes to see The Current War, the director's cut, and I wish you the absolute best with this film
Thank
and
you.
Whatever projects you have coming up.
Thank you so much.
All right, take care.
Thanks.